C1M. Number 2A.
I like the Saturdays very much because on a Saturday one can play on the tones which everybody already knows. And on Sunday I have always a feeling I like a plow. I have to cut through the through the field first. So let's be a bit considerate with ourselves and just see that as we cut new ground it may be a bit harder going, but we will reap the fruits afterwards when we can just play on the tones as we did yesterday. Now let's take the introduction. The introduction says, when our great teacher came to him for baptism, John was astounded. Reading his thoughts, Jesus added, "Suffer it to be so now, for thus it becomes to fulfill all righteousness." Jesus' concessions in certain cases to material methods were for the advancement of spiritual good. Now, I'm impressed, as I said before, by the fact that the great teacher was willing to bow down and to start there where the world was and to make that concession to the world where the world could understand him and follow him. And I think it needs greatness to start with the chapter on marriage, because one has found a high ideal in Atonement and Eucharist, and now one has to put that under the stress of circumstances. One has to take it down into everyday life and see if it can stand the strain of the experiences. And so we see that if Jesus did that, he said that he did it as a suffering to be so now, transitionally. Just as she afterwards shows that marriage is temporal. It is a suffer it to be so now and not a suffer it to be so forever. It is a transitionary stage out of which we have to grow out. But it is a transitionary stage which has a purpose, namely for the advancement of spiritual good. And so concessions which Jesus made, we must see that they were made for something good, for something which is progressive. Because in human life, we are faced so often with the necessity or with the demand to make concessions. And the human mind is only too willing to make concessions. And so we must be careful that we are not going to make anywhere concessions because Jesus made a concession. And we just can rely and say, well, Jesus made also concessions. These concessions must always have a name, namely the advancement of spiritual good. If they can be made for that purpose, then they can be justified and have their place. It is as if here concessions were presented as that which is necessary in order to consolidate something which has already been achieved in the line of good. That so often in our life we must see that we consolidate that which humanity has achieved in the line of progress. And we'll see as we go afterwards through the subject, especially the first subject, see that we should honor that what humanity has been demonstrating and achieving in the line of spiritual good. And if it is not yet the spiritual ultimate and the climax and the best and the highest, though it is only a comparative state in a comparative form, we have the duty and the privilege to consolidate that which has been already achieved, and not to neglect it and not to bypass it. But I quite agree that the question where to make concession, how far to make concession, is a very difficult question. And I think it is always best been answered when it is motivated by the first chapter and the second chapter. That if we go along prayer and fill our thoughts with that willingness to let God command the way, and that through atonement and Eucharist we are willing to put out of the way all egoistic sense and our own way and our own sense of the way, and the more we can do that, the easier we will find that God speaks to us and shows us the way, even in the human, and shows us where it is wisdom to make concession and where it is just fear which impels us to make concessions. But looking back over Mrs. Eddy's life, one sees that she so often referred to this suffering to be so now. And in the questionnaire, I have given you quite a few references out of Mrs. Eddy's works, which refer to this suffering to be so now. You see, she made these concessions over and over again. Whenever she organized a church, it was always with the sense, suffering to be so now. She used that sentence over and over. It was her concession to organize materially Christ Church, concession to ordain pastors, to dedicate churches, to establish a material form of communion. But she always said it is a suffering to be so now, a concession, she said, to the period, and a concession to the beginning. She never made these concession and the suffering to be so now to be eternal. It was always adapted to a period and to a beginning. And often she shows that when these institutions have accomplished their timely purpose, that then it is progress to disorganize these organizations, to relinquish these concessions, just as she showed it also in connection with the communion service in the Mother Church. It is, as she says, relinquishing this concession is for the advancement of the world in truth and love. In truth and love. We'll see in the seven subjects or in marriage, but really when we come to the subject of truth and love, that these concessions dwindle and dwindle and dwindle and prepare the highway so that with the chapter on Christian Science versus Spiritualism, we enter into the realm of the real. Or she made concessions in treatment. She says that also Jesus called the disease by name. These instances show the concessions which Jesus was willing to make to popular ignorance of spiritual life laws. Speaks there about naming maladies and naming diseases and so on. All this is a concession. But they may be for the advancement of spiritual good. They may be right, as she says, to make a concession to popular or ignorance of the spiritual laws. And one of the concessions which she points out in the prose work is rather interesting and quite worthwhile considering. She speaks there in miscellaneous writings, what is evil, she asks, what is evil? And she says, it is a suppositional absence of good. Then she goes on and says, from a human standpoint of good, mortals must first choose between evils. See, she says, they must first choose between evils, not between evil and good. Between evils. And of two evils, choose the less. And at present, the application of scientific rules to human life seems to rest on this basis. Or, in a similar way, she speaks in Science and Health and says, an improved belief is one step out of error, but it's still a belief. But an improved belief, she says, is one step out of error and aids, you see, it's again an aid, in taking the next step and in understanding the situation in Christian Science. So we can see that the situation in the human presents itself very often, not so much as a choosing between good and evil, but between a better evil and a less and a worse evil, between an improved belief, or to choose an improved belief as one step out of error and as an aid in taking the next step. This whole question is practical, because as we have seen, if we have that high ideal of atonement and Eucharist, where that wedding of man to God is presented as the wedding of the idea man with the principle of man, that this high goal may not be achieved in its first goal, and that it is a high goal which seems to be above our capabilities and abilities to demonstrate and to live. And so we must take the next best which we are able to do. It comes now to the comparative, to the next best we can do. And the next best is already better than the next worst we can do. This whole subject was a very crucial subject in the early Christian period. What we consider in the chapter marriage may be compared with the time of the epistles, of the period of primitive Christianity in the first and second, or perhaps even third century after Christ. There too, the disciples and all the many converts who have been preached to by Paul and Peter and so on about this new faith, they had difficulty in accepting this high religion, high sense of this new religion at once. And at one time, the young church was shaken by a lot of sects which professed to what is called antinomianism. Antinomianism is a term which applies to many sects of the early Christian Church, and which means nothing else but this, that the moral law, this is a definition of antinomianism, that the moral law is of no use or obligation on the ground that faith alone is necessary to salvation. See, at that time they just couldn't reconcile the spiritual teaching of the risen Christ with everyday life. They couldn't reconcile that. So these sects which professed to antinomianism said, well, all that is necessary for salvation is to have a spiritual faith in Christ Jesus. And all the rest, what happens in the human and material, is anyway not of the spiritual realm. And so it doesn't matter at all. That they could do what they would like, what they wanted to do in the human and in the moral and in the material and with their animal instincts, they just could do whatever they liked in the flesh, because the spiritual ultimate is anyway only spiritual and does not mingle with the material. And it is against these sects that especially Paul was preaching. And perhaps if you have read Gordon Brown's new book, he points out there is how also in the second epistle of Peter, how Paul had quite a good go at one of these sects, at the how are they called? Docetites. Docetites. There are just one sect of these who believed in antinomianism. Gordon Brown says that there too, says they believe that the material world has no connection with the world of spirit, so one is at liberty to indulge the flesh. See, in one way they reasoned from their point of view very categorically, and so we must be very glad to see that there is a solution to that controversy, which right from the beginning of Christian teaching was a very great question. And here in marriage, she builds up the solution and shows that there is no controversy, but that we have to see that the spiritual is supreme in the material, and that the spiritual has its place in our everyday life insofar as that we have to give to it its supremacy in our affection, in our life, in our actions, and so on. And so right through the chapter on marriage goes that tender sense of constant ascendancy and ascendancy of the good over evil, the ascendancy of the spiritual over the animal in us, the ascendancy of the finer and refined over the grossness and barbarity of the human mind. And in this way, she shows here that the solution is so often not to choose between good and evil, but between two evils, and choose the less. And that an improved belief is one step further out of error. Well, I can't take all these notes here, but they will give us an indication, you see, how far a concession is and can be an improved state. So often when one is a beginner in Christian Science, one is perhaps young, one always wants to go to the extremes. One has two extremes. And the chapter on marriage bridges these extremes and makes use of everything that is worthwhile being preserved. Yes. Now, let me quickly compare the beginning of the chapter with the end of the chapter, because I do that very often, because it helps usually to see the span and the range of a chapter. For instance, we will see that at the beginning of the chapter she speaks that marriage is the legal and moral provision for generation among humankind. This is for generation and propagation of humankind. But at the end of the chapter, we find something very different. Namely, that she says, but proportionately, as human generation ceases, so there must be an end to that beginning. As generation ceases, the unbroken links of eternal harmonious being will be spiritually discerned. And men not of the earth, earthly, but coexistent with God will appear. So we see the span of the chapter. It is starting with the provisions which must be made for the generation and propagation of mortals, leading up at the end of the chapter to the point where she says, but that generation must one day cease, and when it ceases, we begin to see that the unbroken links of eternal harmonious being are always intact, and that God, that man coexisted forever with God. So it's a wide span, you see. Or, if we compare the beginning with the end in another respect, we will see that if she postulates at the beginning those provisions which are necessary that man can be a creator and is a creator, and that he creates without that he decreases virtue. And at the end of the chapter, she asks, do you teach? Someday the child will ask his parents, do you keep the first commandment? Do you have one God and creator, or is man a creator? See, she starts with the regulations which should rule man as a creator, and shows the regulations for creation, for mortal creation, and ends up with the question, but do you really keep the first commandment? Is man a creator? She starts at the beginning with some of Moses' commandments, like thou shalt not commit adultery and thou shalt not kill, which are in the second set of his commandments, which concern more the moral commandments. But she ends by asking, do you keep the first set of commandments? Do you keep the first commandment? Thou shalt have no other gods beside me. See, it's again a span which shows that it is an upward trend going through the whole chapter. And therefore, it looks to be a very gentle and loving chapter, because it seems that it starts with those propositions which at the moment we are able to fulfill, not with propositions which we say, oh, they are too high and I can't fulfill them, I'm not yet big enough for that, and I'm not yet strong enough for that, and so on. it seems to be a very loving chapter, saying, all right, I start there where you are and what you can fulfill. And I lead you on and on and on, though I don't spare you at the end of the chapter some pertinent questions about being. But until then, we may be willing to accept the higher demands. And so we can start with the first subject. Now, the first two chapters were laid out in the 7x7 structure, and chapter on marriage here is laid out according to the structure of the first record of creation. We have 7 subjects. The first has 3 tones, second 3 tones, fourth, the third 5 tone, the fourth 5 tone, the fifth 4 tone, the sixth 7 tones, and the seventh has 7 tones, and not 2 as in the days of creation. But that doesn't mean anything, because the seventh day in creation has the tone of love as truth and love as love, and truth is always the recapitulation of all the preceding ones. So that doesn't interfere very much if Mrs. Eddy presents now the last tone in the seventh and gives a wider explanation of truth. So here we are with mind. As I said, each subject in marriage presents certain qualities to which we should adhere. In the first subject, these qualities which are presented here and which I would like you to look up yourself and to ponder about it yourself are qualities which I would say of respect for law. She appeals here in the first subject to respect of law and regulations, that we subject ourselves to moral regulations, to legal and moral provisions, that we keep commandments, which again is respect for law. And so we get at once the touch of mind. I think that you can see very easily. Respect for law, translated to the human plane of living, namely to respect to regulations, to statutes, to provisions, to legal provisions, moral provisions, and even to the commandments.